He was a morbidly obese surgeon destined for an operating table and an early death. Now he's a rebel MD who is fabulously fit and fighting to make America healthy again. This is Stay Off My Operating Table with Dr. Philip Ovadia.
We do, and we are live. Hey, y'all, welcome to the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast with Dr. Philip Ovadia. We have with us today Nina Teicholz, and we started a conversation that was so cool. I said, we got to record this. So, Nina, welcome to the show. Ask that same question that you said, and then let's keep it going.
Thanks for having me. Well, I was telling you before we started recording that there is the American Heart Association came out with a new paper today that ranked popular diets, and it very much resembles the Consumer Reports Best Diet issue that comes out every January, which puts keto, low carb, dead last due to the saturated fat content primarily that is potentially in those diets. Well, I mean, I don't know if your audience knows that the book that I wrote, The Big Fat Surprise, was really the first sustained argument, I mean, set of arguments laying out the case for why saturated fats had been unfairly villainized and do not, after all, are not supported by the evidence that they cause heart disease. So, and I just feel, I mean, that book came out 9 years ago. And since then, I recently pulled together a table, which I tweeted out today, about how there have been, I mean, in the last 13 years, there have been at least 22 systematic reviews of all the data on saturated fats and heart disease. I'm sure you're familiar with some of these. There was a very famous one that came out, state-of-the-art review in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, which I guess, Philip, you will confirm is an important journal, saying that the evidence, the clinical trial evidence and observational evidence, does not support a continued numeric caps, like a 10% cap that we currently have, on saturated fats as a percent of calories. But it's a really fascinating story and a disturbing one as to why the American Heart Association really persists with this idea that saturated fats are what's driving heart disease. And we can talk about that if you like.
Well, this is the place where I would insert the welcome to the show music, because that's a great teaser about who you are and what you're going to talk about. But we should probably do a slightly better introduction than I did. Phil, who is this woman and why is she talking like this?
Well, you know, I don't think Nina's really going to need any introduction. I think anyone that's in our audience and is following me will have surely come across her work. As Nina said, you know, I can't believe it's 2014, almost 10 years ago, that you wrote The Big Fat Surprise, which I consider to be an essential reading for anyone interested in nutrition. And it really doesn't matter which side of the debates you might be on, just, you know, the scientific investigative techniques that Nina brings to the nutritional question in that book, I think is useful for anyone. Besides being an author and a journalist, Nina is also an activist for better nutrition in our society, in our schools, the Nutrition Coalition, which is her nonprofit organization, has done some fabulous work on that front. So really excited to have her on and really excited to jump right into the conversation around the American Heart Association, since it is really breaking news that they published this thing today. And it's interesting that, you know, the what they published was basically evaluating how well diets align with their recommendations. And, you know, it really has nothing to do with what are the outcomes of those diets and therefore the recommendations. And, you know, this is really one of the high level questions that I'd love to hear Nina's thoughts on. The American Heart Association has been making the same recommendations essentially now for 30 plus years, 40 plus years, really.
60.
Yeah. Well, you can go back all the way to the 1950s. But, you know, even if we say, okay, 1980 is when they really started with the saturated fat guidelines, and heart disease isn't getting any better. And, you know, what people might not realize is every 5 to 10 years, the American Heart Association releases their new, you know, 10 and 20 year goals in terms of reduction of heart disease. And as far as I know, they have never met those goals. They fail every single cycle. So the fact that they say, you know, we're going to keep recommending the same things, we're not getting the outcomes we want. And it's, you know, and here are the diets that go along with those recommendations that you should be eating, seems kind of crazy to me. But, you know, how did we get here, and why does it continue, I guess, is the big question.
Well, it's a big story. And when I started this, my research as a journalist, I was a vegetarian and had been for more than 20 years, not eating red meat. And I plunged into this subject and took nearly a decade and read, you know, thousands of studies to try to understand what had happened. And I pieced together the history of how many people know the story of Ansel Keys from the University of Minnesota, who came up with what's called the diet heart hypothesis in the 1950s, that saturated fat and dietary cholesterol cause heart disease by clogging the arteries, but sort of by raising your blood cholesterol and clogging the arteries. That was his idea. And really, the American Heart Association was not just any organization. It was the organization that first issued the advice to avoid saturated fat. The first advice anywhere in the world came out of the American Heart Association, which Ansel Keys had joined the nutrition committee of and was steering its guidance. So in 1961, that is the first advice that any group issued anywhere in the world telling people to cut back on saturated fats and dietary cholesterol. So, well, the first recommendation didn't include dietary cholesterol. It was mainly saturated fat, and it evolved to be total fat, but that's where it all began. So we really are talking like 60 years of advice, and it was hugely influential because the nation was in a complete panic about the rising tide of heart disease, which had been virtually unknown in the early 1900s, but had risen to become the number one killer. President Eisenhower famously had a heart attack in 1955, was out of the Oval Office. There was a real panic about what was the explanation for these sudden heart attacks that were felling men in the prime of life. So into that vacuum stepped the American Heart Association, which is really the premier group at the time dealing with heart disease. I mean, it still is today, but it was really the only group in time. At that time, there were no dietary guidelines, no American College of Cardiology. That was it, the American Heart Association. So they have a legacy interest in maintaining this advice. I think that's probably the first point. If you look through the 22 plus reviews on all the data on saturated fats, the American Heart Association's review, which it called a presidential advisory in 2018, they stand out. You know, they say unequivocally saturated fats cause heart disease. That's their legacy position. They started it. The other, you know, I would say that their 20 other reviews say, we cannot find the evidence for this recommendation. So they're really outliers. And their review ignores all the outcome data on what's called hard endpoints. So cardiovascular mortality, total mortality, cardiovascular deaths, myocardial infarction. They ignore that data and just focus exclusively on LDL cholesterol. In any case, they remain outliers. I mean, it's really quite striking to see this continued fixation on saturated fat. And, you know, beyond this sort of conflict of interest sort of that they have as an organization for having started this whole recommendation, they have a lot. They have corporate conflicts of interest. They, at least 20-25% of their funds come from pharmaceutical companies, food companies, including, going back to their original inception, the Procter & Gamble, maker of vegetable oils, you know, Crisco, which is the oil you're supposed to, you know, vegetable oils is what you're supposed to eat in place of saturated fats. So, I mean, they have real conflicts of interest. And, you know, I would just say, like, on top of the all the disappointment I feel about this article, there's the added layer of disappointment of seeing our media report on it. Washington Post, NBC News. I mean, some of these journalists, I know, you know, they've written articles about the changing science on saturated fats. And I just see them kind of, there's just, they're retreating into this very vanilla, very kind of just credulous, non-questioning reporting now on this paper. And it's so very disappointing to see, because, you know, if journalists are not calling this out, well, then who's going to really be, who's going to stand up for the science?
We could just take the whole diet saturated fat subject out of your last statement. And that basically applies to the alleged profession of journalism over the last Humpty Hump years. I have two questions. One is personal and one is professional. So you were a vegetarian for, you said, 20 years. As you began studying this, clearly you said, maybe I was misled. Tell us about the changes you made in diet and how you experienced those changes in your own health.
Well, I'm sure you've interviewed many people on your show who have been through this same transformation, realization. For me, I'm driven very much by data. I mean, I had, like most people, been completely fat phobic and phobic of especially of red meat. I just thought it was the worst possible thing you could eat. I didn't eat butter. I was just completely steeped in all of that, what I now know to be sort of mythology that I had grown up having, you know, Captain Crunch and non-fat milk literally for breakfast. And then, you know, for me, it really was reading the science. I mean, I've never been a reader of self-help books. I never followed people about diet or nutrition. Every time I went to a nutritionist, they sort of told me I needed to cut back on my saturated fat and reduce, you know, eat more fruits and vegetables. And I just believed that all, even though it wasn't working for me. Somehow I didn't make that connection until I really read the science myself and understood the story. And even then, it was extremely hard for me to order meat, buy a piece of meat. There's another story here, which is that I had this little restaurant review column in a giveaway free paper when I first moved to New York City. And I went to restaurants to review them. And because I was doing this unpaid, I just had to eat whatever the restaurant wanted to send out for me. I couldn't be like paying for my meals. And what the chefs often sent out were what they considered at the time, this is 20 years ago, to be excellent food. So it was red meat and, you know, tripe and foie gras and, you know, things that I had never eaten and was terrified of eating. But doing my job, I ate those things. Mysteriously, I found myself losing weight, which was just mystifying. And I go to my doctor. He's like, "Your cholesterol looks better, actually, Nina." So that was just another data point that was really, kind of a paradox for me at the time. But, you know, mainly it was reading the science.
So why did you start reading the science?
I was doing a series of, I got a book contract to write a book on what was supposed to be a book on trans fats. And that came out of a story that I did for Gourmet Magazine, which really was the first major story to come out in the media on what was wrong with trans fats. This is 2003. And it was a huge article for Gourmet Magazine. It was calling, you know, it was like documenting how the vegetable oil scientists were harassing and heckling scientists at conferences for raising problems about trans fats. I mean, it was really kind of an eye opener for me. And there, and I was given a book contract to write about trans fats. But then the deeper that I looked into this subject of fat, you know, what have Americans obsessed about more than anything else in their diet, right? Good fat, bad fat, low fat, how much fat. I mean, all of that has been a central obsession. And I realized it was just a much bigger subject. And so my book, I mean, unbeknownst to me, my book ended up being about saturated fats and their replacement by vegetable oils. Although I didn't go into it thinking that. Yeah. It was also, you know, the first real compilation of information about seed oils and the problems, you know, of inflammation and all of the toxic degraded fatty acid products that came out of it when you heat oils. I mean, that was all like, that was the beginning and of that, you know, whole seed oil movement.
Yeah. And let's dig into that a little bit more. Cause I think, you know, here we are, you know, now 20 years later from that. And I think a lot of people have sort of forgotten about the trans fat thing. You know, they don't realize like how prominent this was, how this was pushed, you know, all of the low fat products that came out of the recommendations from the, you know, American Heart Association and the US Dietary Guideline to get fat out of our diets. And you know, these trans fats were introduced as a heart healthy fat alternative. And it was an unmitigated disaster. I mean, you know, there's really no other way to put it. It killed people. And it sort of quietly went away, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, there was a little bit of a movement, get trans fat out of everything. And, you know, trans fat was removed from everything, a lot slower here in the US than it was internationally. But eventually, you know, and now here we are, you know, probably been, I don't know, 10, 15 years since the, you know, trans fat bans, that it's not in anything anymore. And people have forgotten that and don't realize that, you know, it's very easy to see that we may have made the same mistakes, you know, in our evaluation of these polyunsaturated fats and these vegetable and seed oils.
Here's why it's relevant today. And really, you have to go back to 1911 and the introduction of Crisco oil and Crisco, you know, Crisco, the hardened oil, which was supposed to and did come to replace lard. Okay, that was the introduction of vegetable oils into the American food supply. And I sort of documented how that, you know, they rose very quickly to become the dominant source of fat that Americans eat, right? There's even just since 1970, I mean, this goes back to 1911, but just there's since 1970, our consumption of seed oils, you know, principally soybean, right? But cottonseed, safflower, sunflower, corn, that has risen 89% since, in terms of our consumption, since just 1970, right? But it's, if you look, there's no food stuff, no source of calories in the American diet that has risen more over the course of the last 100 years than seed oils. So originally they could, and this is sort of still true today, why it's relevant today, they cannot replace saturated fats. They can't replace lard and butter unless you harden them, right? As oils, they're useless for products on a shelf, right? They're oily. Products don't, you know, they just, you can't make a shelf stable product with an oil. So you have to harden it. That process of hardening the oil is called hydrogenation. And a byproduct of hydrogenation is trans fats. Trans fats happen to be just one of many novel, never seen before, individual fatty acids. But trans fats, you know, became uniquely identified, were the subject of research. Going back to the 1970s, there were major concerns about trans fats, which were largely ignored and suppressed. And the people studying that were the people I told you about who were heckled at conferences by industry scientists. So they got rid of trans fats, right? Rightly so. And there was a whole campaign against trans fats. But what are we left with now? We have oils that cannot be hardened through partial hydrogenation anymore. So in many instances, and particularly in fried food in restaurants, they've just gone back to using the regular old oils, right? The regular oils, the original reason that they were hardened is that they're wildly unstable as oils, right? They oxidize very quickly. They cause hundreds of degraded oxidation products. Those oxidation products enter into our bodies when we eat the food, the fried chicken nuggets or whatever's fried in them. They enter our body. They pass through the blood-brain barrier. One of the toxic byproducts that is created is something called aldehydes, which are known to cause cancer and heart disease. They're so wildly unstable. They're almost impossible to study. But, you know, there's researchers who would study these. I mean, this is science going back to Vienna.
Wait a minute.
It's unbelievable. And
we're saying these oils that we're told to use to for all of our cooking are so chemically unstable. They're extremely difficult to study.
Yeah, because they're changing so rapidly. They're degrading so rapidly. So, I mean, if you go to a place like McDonald's.
I keep thinking I can't be surprised anymore. And oh, my God. Okay, sorry.
Read this, but this section of my book is still like so raw. It's called Toxic Heated Oils. And when in restaurants, I mean, until McDonald's figured out how to put silicon beads into the oils to absorb the oxidation products, or nitrogen blankets on top of the oils to prevent them from aerolizing, entering the uniforms of the workers. So the workers' uniforms were spontaneously combusting in the trucks on the way to the dry cleaners because they were so full of these unstable products. They figured out a way to control.
This sounds like the script for the plot of a sitcom or a sci-fi. This is insane. Okay,
it is some scary reading. I mean, I'm not here to like sell my book, but I'll tell you, this is really scary reading, and this problem has not been solved. I mean, that's why it's, you know, when you go out to eat at a restaurant, the reason not to eat fried foods is, you know, maybe you don't want to overeat, you know, have excessive fats, but the reason not to eat fried foods is because they're almost 100% fried in these toxic inflammatory oils. And that's the danger. And also, the rise in vegetable oils perfectly parallels the rise in heart disease in America, right? I'm not saying that is the only cause. I don't think we fully know the cause of heart disease, but I mean, it's definitely not saturated fats, which have been declining. Animal fats have declined during the whole time that heart disease has been rising. So just going back to that particular point, but you know, vegetable oils are really to be, you know, feared, especially when they're heated, but even when they're just on your, you know, on your kitchen counter and they're the light, the heat, the time they're there, they will oxidize and become rancid over time.
Yeah. Well, so experience
they're
that
really
myself.
Scary.
Yeah, no, it is really scary. And, you know, there are plenty of videos you can pull up, you know, on how these things are made and just the insane chemical processes that they need to go through to make them palatable. And again, you know, this all started with Crisco, which was, you know, a company trying to find a way to use their industrial byproducts, you know, essentially, make them edible.
Because what happened was, we need fat was used for lubricants in industrial machinery, right? So the late 1800s, the Industrial Revolution happens. There's a tremendous need for fats. The whales, which had previously been the source for, you know, the use of oil in street lamps and, you know, had been used for all these purposes, candle making. We hunted the whales practically to extinction. Then somebody figures out in America how to use the byproduct of cotton seed oil, and you can press oil out of those seeds. That became this byproduct. They didn't know what to do with it. They used it to lubricate machinery for the Industrial Revolution. That machine lubricant then became a foodstuff for us. Really not having had, any kind of significant exposure to human, human populations, just hadn't been exposed to that. And if you, I went through and looked through all the scientific research on going back, to the, in the 30s and after, and looking at, say, who was studying these oils? Why didn't we know anything about them? And there was really a concerted effort to try to starve the oxygen out of that field of scientific research. So you see studies that are deeply concerning about, animal studies where the rats are like, they've got shellac sticking themselves to the bottom of the cage because they've, because the oils harden and when they're metabolized. And this research, these conferences, like nobody's sponsoring these conferences. There's no research. It just sort of goes quiet. And that actually remains the case today, that it's really difficult to get any research funded on these oils. And there's almost no scholarship on them.
So, yeah, and kind of circling that back to the larger topic of nutrition, one positive, I guess we could say about this article that came from the American Heart Association today is at least they acknowledged that low carbohydrate diets exist. And I know this has been a challenge, that you've been fighting with the U.S. Dietary Guideline committees every, cycle, every five-year cycle. And for the last two cycles, they've basically refused to acknowledge that low-carb diets even exist or that anyone can do them. And they've said that there's no science on them. So talk a little bit about that challenge.
Well, if you search low-carb, carbohydrate and ketogenic in the government database of scientific studies, if you just search clinical trials, which is, considered the highest form of evidence, the hardest kind of research to do because it involves an actual experiment where you feed people or you alter their diets, there's almost 1,500 papers on clinical trials on low carb and ketogenic. And this was true, close to that number was true for the last set of dietary guidelines where they said, we're going to study low carbohydrate diets, but then they couldn't find any studies. So somehow they missed all 1,500 of these papers, even though one of the members on their expert committee, this is for the 2020 guidelines, came out in 2020 and will last till 2025. A member of their expert committee had herself been the author of a low carbohydrate clinical trial, which found it better compared to controls in terms of metabolic outcomes. I can't remember exactly. No, they found this many studies 5 years earlier.
For those who are only listening, she made a big zero with her hand.
Right. Zero studies. 5 years earlier for the 2015 dietary guidelines, because they're updated every 5 years, supposedly with the new science, they did a formal review of the low carbohydrate diet, but they, and I only found this out because I filed as a journalist, I filed Freedom of Information Act requests and got emails and found out that they had talked about this systematic review of low carbohydrate studies. They found something like 43 studies and then they stuffed it. They didn't publish it in the outcomes section of their scientific report. They just pretended like it just didn't exist. This whole systematic review that I have a copy of, and I've written about this from my Substack column, which maybe you can post the link to, but
let's do that.
The point is they did this review in 2015, found 43 studies. 2020, they go back, they can find zero studies. They can't even remember the last 43 studies that they found 5 years earlier. And now for the next set of guidelines due out in 2030, they're not even going to, they currently say they're just not even going to study the diet. Like there will be no review of the low carbohydrate or ketogenic literature, despite the fact that other than the Mediterranean diet, I don't think any other what's called dietary pattern, but you know, any other diet has been studied as robustly in as many clinical trials as low carb slash ketogenic. None. And when they do reviews of low carb versus Mediterranean, low carb comes out better on almost all metrics in terms of fighting heart disease, weight loss, metabolic, you know, glycemic control, control of your blood sugars. I mean, almost it, low carb almost always looks better in those review papers. So it's just really mystifying and hard to understand how the science is. I mean, I think it's hard to use a word other than suppress at this point. It's literally being suppressed and ignored. And that's very disturbing state of affairs.
So you're not a doctor, a healthcare provider, a scientist. You're a journalist. And my suspicion is that as a journalist, when you run into things like you just laid out, it provokes curiosity on your part. What's going on? Why is this? Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Journalists are supposed to ask questions about, I mean, famously, like follow the money, right? Or find what is going on? What are the politics? What are the economics here? If I were covering the Defense Department, I wouldn't just say, hey, the Defense Department came out and said all its fighter planes were working perfectly and, you know, no questions asked. But in nutrition, that is precisely what we have. We have people, we have journalists, usually they come out of cookbook writing or, you know, the lifestyle section, and nobody is taught to question the motives or the financial interests. We're talking like a $12 trillion industries between the food and pharmaceutical industries, and nobody's asking the question of what might be the financial conflicts of interest here? What might be the motives here? There is actually no journalists who are pursuing these kinds of questions, or almost none. I mean, I really can't think of anybody off the top of my head. So there's a tremendous need for journalism in this area. It's just astonishing to me. Again, I'm still just reeling from today, but not a single study questions this advice coming out of the American Heart Association. Not one journalist is saying like, who funds the American Heart Association? Or what about the lead author on the study, Christopher Gardner, who's a avowed vegan who is against saturated fats because any liberation of saturated fats allows for eating more meat. Two of his major studies have been funded by Beyond Meat, the meat replacement
company. Food.
He's highly biased. And I don't see anybody else on that panel of authors who's balancing out his bias, right? What I see is another name, Linda Van Horn, who's spent her entire 50-year career trying to prove that saturated fats are bad for health. So, I mean, we ought to have a depth of expertise in the journalists covering these topics. And sadly, I just don't see that out there. It signals to a huge need for better information for average, you know, just for curious, interested individuals who want to get some straight talk about, you know, what can I trust? What studies can I trust? What is the disconnect here?
What does it cost you personally or professionally to have pursued this particular line of questioning and to have published your findings?
You know, that's hard to say. I have to say that, you know, I'm committed to trying to understand the truth here, and it never tires me because it's a broad and hugely interesting field. It has come at a personal cost. I mean, I have suffered a lot of personal attacks and efforts to defame me. There's been pieces written about how I'm allegedly funded by the meat industry or that I'm a lobbyist, none of which is true. I have zero conflicts of interest and make a point of not taking money from any industry. And the same is true for the Nutrition Coalition. But, I know that in a big pharma boardroom or maybe Kellogg's or General Mills, there's a group of people who are working to try to, you know, to attack me. I mean, I see it, you know, I'll see attacks on Twitter attacks, and then all of a sudden there's like 50 people I've never seen before who are attacking something that I've written. And I, you know, that's just recognizable as a industry attack. And, but you know, you can only like really, I mean, I think there's just no other option than to try to speak the truth. I mean, I don't know. I don't see any other choice. You know, if you want to, you know, if you want to do something good in the world, and, you know, if you want to help people, I mean, mainly I just believe in the truth. I believe truth is a kind of justice, and I know I can't give up on that.
Yeah. I mean, and I think truth ultimately has to be our North Star and our guiding light. And, you know, it in a lot of ways, it's the same, you know, truth that has led me, you know, down my pathway and seeing, you know, the outcomes that patients were getting, you know, and ultimately that's the truth for me. You know, right. If we have supposedly figured out the cause of heart disease, then why isn't heart disease going away? But expand on that a little bit more. You know, what do you see as our path forward? How do we continue to get people the information that they need, and how do we change minds in the face of, you know, these other forces that are out there, we'll say, that are just heavily invested in pushing this other message?
Well, Phil, I think, you know, in part, it's like what you're doing and what many other folks are doing, which is to try to share information, grow audiences, provide alternative sources of information. I also strongly believe that there needs to be a united movement for change that people, and that's one of the things, you know, what the Nutrition Coalition, I won't go into its whole history, but what it's really working on now is building that advocacy movement, having potentially hundreds of thousands of people all joining in to object to the fact that there's no limit on the amount of sugar they can serve our kids in public schools, or there, you know, whatever the issue is, there's no possibility of getting a low carbohydrate diet in a hospital in many, many places. Or you can't get them on an airplane, which is less inconvenient if you're, you know, you're in a fat adapted state. But still, I mean, all of these issues are going to require organized advocacy efforts. And so for anybody who's interested, go to nutritioncoalition.us and, you know, sign up for our newsletter, which is how you'll join and get information. I mean, I'm no longer the director, but you know, I think that it's going to take a unified movement of people, educating friends and families, having strength in numbers, because we are up against truly formidable forces. And so I think it's really going to be like a grassroots movement for change. And, you know, I would just add one wrinkle in that there's a growing number of self-insured private companies and, you know, Medicaid, also Blue Cross, Blue Shield, that are discovering that they can save money by getting their people healthy. And I think that's another force for change. That is that there are hundreds of these private corporations, entities now, insurers, that have grown, you know, because of the work of companies like Virta, folks like yourself, Dr. Tro. I mean, it's just there's going to be a growing awareness amongst people who actually their bottom line depends on having healthy workers.
Right. I'd like to explore the question that that doesn't have anything to do with this particular subject, nutrition, food, oils, fats, but has to do with journalism itself. You've pinpointed a problem that isn't unique to food science or nutrition, which is the lack of curiosity about the disconnect between stated goals and actual outcomes you know, I'm a child of the 70s. I can remember sitting and watching the Watergate hearings in the summer of 73, I think it was, or maybe summer of 74. And I was too young to understand what was going on, but it dominated everything. And it was primarily because of the work of two journalists who, I guess, followed the money. And as I was growing up, the hope that you could become a Woodward or a Bernstein seemed to animate literally every student at a J school for I don't know how long. And something changed.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, you know, Watergate was truly a watershed moment in the history of journalism. It was not as strong a countervailing force to government before then, and it certainly has been severely weakened since then. I mean, what we see now, I mean, truly lamentably, is that in many of our, you know, our legacy media, the journalists they're acting to reinforce and parrot really government statements rather than acting as what we call the fourth estate, which is, you know, right, another branch of government that exists to keep in check the power of the establishment. That has truly been lost. And, you know, whether, I mean, this is a huge conversation, but, you know, it's corporate, you know, corporate advertising and takeovers of many of our major media, or to ideological changes that are, you know, our journalists are now more fully aligned with the values of the Democratic Party and are, you know, really politicized or with on the right, you know, if you want to take a Fox News, also, you know, very much politicized. We no longer have media trying to appeal to the larger general public because we've been polarized, given the lack, you know, given that we've now all sort of exist on social media and our audiences have been splintered. I mean, there's a long conversation to be had about all that. I think in the area of pharmaceutical drug companies and food companies, the media has just been decimated. I don't, you know, I see even 10 years ago, when I look at the media that came out, you know, Gary Taubes, a regular contributor to the Sunday New York Times section. I was an op-ed writer who got my pieces placed in the New York Times. The challenges to the low-fat diet, challenges to the government, challenges to, you know, conventional dietary advice and how do we explain obesity, that is gone. You know, even in today's coverage on the American Heart Association story, there's a journalist who wrote about the problems of the problems and evidence of saturated fat, did a profile of Asim Malhotra, who came out with a piece on, you know, challenging saturated fat conventional wisdom, like back in 2013. And, you know, he's a cardiologist. He's now well known for other issues. But, you know, these journalists have just crawled into a hole. So I see the journalism on these topics becoming much more timid. I mean, look at the rollout of Wegovy, Ozempic, all these obesity drugs, and you do not see the media really challenging the tremendous problems with that, putting people on a medication that, you know, ultimately should be lifelong, but starts to fail within 1 to 2 years and then leads to greater fat regain. I mean, there should be an outcry about that, but I just don't see it. I don't know if you do.
Yeah, no, I mean, and again, we don't have to go that far back to see, you know, some of the major issues that have come out of the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, you look at the opioid crisis and you look at, you know, what happened with the Sackler, you know, family and that whole story really, you know, it got some attention, but it really didn't get the attention that it should have on the broader pharmaceutical industry. You know, it was painted as this was just one, you know, one bad actor. But we really, you know, have lost the ability to question the pharmaceutical industry. And you know, that occurs in journalism. And quite frankly, it occurs in medicine, you know, in the clinical practice, you know, if you want to question something like, you know, should we be prescribing all these statin medications? You can't do it. You know, it's completely squashed any science that might go against that.
Yeah. If you look at, you know, sort of more popular medical publications like Medscape, MedPage, Today, WebMD, their coverage is, I mean, through my, you know, interpretation of it is it's highly informed from a pharmaceutical perspective, right? They're they, you know, they stuff any kind of reports on nutritional approaches that are actually successful at reversing diseases that might decrease the need for more medication. And they're, you know, they're really consistently pushing a plant-based diet, which is, you know, I mean, it might be good for some people, but is just backed by almost zero evidence. So it's really not an evidence-based approach to reversing disease, despite what people hear over and over and over again. So I see that in the medical press as well. And there's I mean, you know, I truly feel sorry for the average consumer because, you know, where do you go for information that you feel like you can reliably trust? And, you know, if it were me starting out on this journey, I would think I'm not going to YouTube videos and I'm not going, you know, what can I actually trust out there? And it's, you know, I think it's difficult to get one's bearings if you're starting off this health journey. I mean, when my book came out, I will say, you know, it was like a best book of the year and it was acclaimed by The Economist. It was reviewed by the BMJ and the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition and The Lancet and all these. But I think that, you know, that wouldn't happen today. I think that there's just been a pretty dramatic shift. And it's not just industry interests. It's, again, this plant-based diet that has truly caught the imagination of our leading elites who believe this is the way to save the planet. And so there's, you know, a whole kind of almost moral imperative from, you know, some of these.
From the most immoral people on the planet.
Yeah. I mean, they just feel like we have to eat this way or we'll lose the planet. And they you know, they don't understand the nutritional arguments. They don't know the environmental arguments have been hastily put together and never really debated. I mean, but I know that, for example, Richard Horton, editor-in-chief of The Lancet, he's completely signed on to that. He feels like that's his pledge to doing good on the planet, even he doesn't understand or hasn't looked into any of these more nuanced issues. So it's just this added layer of bias now that's built into all of our nutrition coverage.
You know, I was a securities trader back in the 2008 when everything blew up. And I worked for myself. Nobody was paying my bills. I had to eat what I killed. And to mix a metaphor there. And it was obvious to me.
Were you a hunter?
I was hunting profits. Yeah, I was hunting good trades. And I remember very clearly watching the federal government. In fact, I actually got on a plane 15 years ago, just about this week, flew to Manhattan and joined with a bunch of other fellow independent traders to gather in front of the offices of J.P. Morgan and protest the bailout of Bear Stearns by the federal government, because it looked to me like they were just kind of picking winners and losers based on whoever, I don't know, lying to somebody's pocket. And it was clear as the whole thing unfolded that there was no interest in the little guy. There was no interest in taking care of what we would call Main Street. It was all about bailing out the big bettors who just bet wrong on Wall Street. And from that point forward, I see the same thing. I've seen the same thing happen in industry after industry after industry. I don't understand why, but I recognize the signs. And what you're describing to me is just simply the exact same thing. We've got a handful of big players in a handful of incredibly profitable industries that are saying whatever, I don't know, you can't talk about this, and anybody who does is going to be blacklisted. So,
you know, there's a line from the book on the Sackler family and the opioid epidemic. The book was called Empire of Pain, a really terrific book. But there's a quote that author uses, I think it's from the 1960s, where from a lawmaker in Capitol Hill who said, I have never seen an industry as sophisticated in their tactics as the pharmaceutical industry. Oil and gas don't even come close.
Wow.
And this is in the 60s. So just imagine how much more sophisticated they are now. And you know, we're just like, you know, we're really lambs to this slaughter because, you know, we're not organized. We don't have sustained files maintained over decades to understand the propaganda battles that are going on out there. I think we're Americans especially are very unsophisticated because we have so long believed that we live in a free and fair and open democracy. And we simply don't believe that we could become victims of the kind of propaganda techniques that I think have been sharpened and weaponized against us. And you know, we're slow to wake up. I certainly have been slow to wake up myself. It's just hard to believe. And you don't want to live in a world like that. You don't want to be that cynical person or feel like people could, that there could be such ill will or say evil in the world. It's not a pleasant place or a pleasant way to exist. So it's why, you know, all of us who are in these battles have to remind ourselves to take a break and go see, you know, touch some of the beauty in the world out there in some way to stay human.
Walk barefoot in the grass in the sunshine.
Yeah. And hug somebody and your loved ones and
tell someone
have a nice
you love
meal
them.
Together. And I mean,
yeah, it's very well important. Said. And I think ultimately, you know, again, it's the power of the individual that's going to change the direction here. And, you know, I think that's, you know, ultimately informing yourself, you know, looking at the results you're getting when it comes to your health from this advice that you're following. You know, these are the things that are going to lead us down a different pathway as individuals. And ultimately, when enough individuals choose to just start walking the other way, you know, that's what leads to change.
Right. And hopefully we'll still have a choice.
Right? Yes.
I mean, you know, Eric Adams in New York City just unveiled a plan to try to limit our, you know, working with Amex card to limit our consumption of red meat and dairy, you know, so that's kind of the next step to try to actually have control over our food purchases, which is deeply scary to me. But yeah, people have to fight. Like, it's important that people organize and fight. We can't just ignore that. And I think those threats are real.
Oh yeah. And you know, it's interesting. You see, you know, again, when they can't convince people, you know, that this is good for them, then they just force it on people.
Right.
And you're exactly right. If we don't stand up to that, all of a sudden we might not have a choice.
Yeah.
So, well, sounds like a good time to put a pin in it. I would love to I've got 800,000 questions, but there's
well, Jack, no, you and I can get on the phone and have a chat later on.
Let's do it. Well, I know you're up against a hard stop, so I want to make sure I've got most of your contact information, but I don't have your Substack. So give us your Substack.
You can go to Substack and look up Unsettled Science, which is my newsletter.
Very good.
But I can send you some links to, you know, for your show notes.
All right. Well, we'll do that. All right. Well, I just want to thank you, Phil, for bringing on one of the most potentially influential guests we've ever had. We've had folks like Dr. Chris Palmer and Dr. Seifritz, the cancer researcher, Dave Feldman, But this is something that affects us, not just from a nutritional standpoint, but from a societal and a cultural standpoint. Thank you, Nina. I'm just Thank thrilled you that you took the time to be with us.
I appreciate it.
All right. Well, wow. For our regular listeners, you know, you can find all the contact information in the show notes. If you're new to the show, and I'm sure many of you are, all the contact information for our guests and for Dr. Avedia are contained in the show notes. I don't have any more to say. That's a mic drop. Phil?
I think that's a wrap. Thank you for all you're doing, Nina.
Thank you both. It's a pleasure Appreciate to talk it. To you.
We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Chances are you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't need to change your life and get healthier. So take action right now. Book a call with Dr. Avedia's team. One small step in the right direction is all it takes to get started. Contact us at ifixhearts.com/talk. That's ifixhearts.com/talk.